Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 30th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. A team of architects this week toured all 32 schools in the Cedar Rapids Community School District as the first step in creating a new facility plan before the district takes another general obligation bond referendum to voters, possibly in November 2025. Next week, people living in the Cedar Rapids School District will begin receiving a survey by mail or email asking for feedback on why a majority of residents voted no on a $220 million bond issue last November. It also will ask what facility projects they would like to see prioritized. On average, the district's school buildings are more than 68 years old. District leaders note heating, electrical, and plumbing systems and roofs and windows have reached or exceeded their service life. Many schools have unused classrooms, which is inefficient financially. Some classrooms are too small for current teaching and learning standards. Updates are needed to address Americans with Disabilities Act requirements to improve access to classrooms and other areas of school buildings, including restrooms. A new facility master plan could include closing buildings to reduce operating costs and eliminate future maintenance expenses. It also could include renovating existing schools and building new ones. The plan also could bring a renewed focus to career and college education programs by building spaces that those programs require. Heath Tate, principal architect at MA Plus Architecture, wrote detailed notes on floor plans of each school and took pictures, walking an average of 6 miles a day while touring the schools over a four-day period. The Oklahoma-based firm was hired in February by the school board under an agreement with Shive Hattery and other consultants to review research on the district's infrastructure, create a facility plan, engage the community, lend assistance in the bond campaign, and create conceptual plans of the school projects. MA Plus Architecture provides professional services in interior design, master planning, bond planning, and furniture selection for schools and other organizations. The work being done by school leaders and consultants will help right-size a bond referendum the community will support, Tate said. Tate also said he has assessed millions of square feet of school spaces during his career. Schools built more than 60 years ago were not designed with the needs of students and teachers today, especially with the technology now used in the classroom, he said. We are walking through, looking at how many students are in a classroom, how much time they are spending between classes getting from point A to point B, and are the classrooms functioning the way they should be for optimal academic achievement, Tate said. Community feedback is vital to creating a facility plan that serves their kids, he added. The first round of surveys being sent out next week aims to gather input from staff, families, and the community on how best to address the Cedar Rapids School District's facilities needs. The five-page survey will come from School Perceptions, an education research firm the district is working with, and will be available in English, Spanish, French, and Swahili. Survey responses will be kept confidential and returned to School Perceptions, which will analyze the data and report the findings to the Cedar Rapids School Board. Results will be available on the district's website. Residents can respond to the survey online. Return the survey to any school office or mail it to School Perceptions. The survey should be completed before April 22nd. A second survey will be sent to residents in the district later this year. Questions on the survey include, did you support the bond? If you voted no, why? And what college and career readiness classes and programs are most important to you? The survey also will ask residents if they would support renewing the physical plant and equipment levy expected to be on the ballot this September. The physical plant and equipment levy, PPEL, is an existing capital projects fund used for the purchase and improvement of grounds, construction, and remodeling of buildings and other major equipment purchases, including technology. It must be renewed by voters every 10 years. If approved, the extension would not raise the existing PPEL tax rate. However, it still wouldn't create enough revenue for the district to build new schools, though it is important for maintaining buildings, said Chad Schumacher, Director of Operations for the Cedar Rapids School District. Michael Kleen, an education architect at Shive Hattery, who was on the school's tour this week, said projects proposed in the facility master plan will be prioritized by looking at the needs of students, the needs of the district, the needs of the community, and the financial realities. While the school district has historically had two plans, one that addressed the elementary schools and a second plan that addressed the middle and high schools, Schumacher said the new plan will be more holistic. He noted Schumacher has met with about 50 community members from different quadrants of the city, different socioeconomic levels, faith backgrounds, business leaders, parents, and people without students in the district. He has a goal of meeting with another 100 people one-on-one by May 1st. He said the feedback indicates people would love to support a school bond issue, but had a hard time supporting the $220 million plan put before voters in November. Questions about the district proposing to build a new middle school without knowing the location led to some voters saying no, Schumacher said. The school district isn't starting completely from scratch. A 2017-18 analysis of the district's elementary schools and a 2022 analysis of the district's secondary buildings still are around. Neither the City of Cedar Rapids nor City Rapids Metro Economic Alliance officials will have a vote in recommending potential changes to downtown's management structure, seemingly putting to rest disagreement over how much say either entity would have in the decision. Determining the structure of downtown Cedar Rapids' managing entity rests with the Downtown Self-Supported Municipal Improvement District Commission, DSSMID, a mayor-appointed panel that decides how businesses' tax dollars are spent within the core district, and with select business leaders who have a stake in the city center. Initially, the SSMID Commission anticipated it would have largely completed its deliberations by now on whether to change the structure of downtown's managing entity. Depending on what's decided, it could shake up who is responsible for routine matters such as maintenance or who runs major events like the summer farmers markets. The SSMID structure has been a sticking point for some, but not all, Cedar Rapids City Council members who see it as a key in driving the newly adopted Downtown Vision Plan. The plan provides a 5-year guide for efforts to revitalize the heart of Cedar Rapids as it emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic and as remote work trends have diminished worker traffic in an office-heavy downtown. To revitalize the city center, the plan calls for it to transition into more of a mixed-use district with restaurants, housing, retail, and other entertainment. But how to get there and the level of involvement of certain players has been up for debate. When adopting the plan, Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said future conversations about organizational structure are going to be critical to the success of this plan. The commission oversees the district where a tax is levied on property owners for beautification projects, programming and maintenance, Currently, the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance provides administrative services to the SSMID, housing the staff who perform maintenance work and execute on downtown projects and goals. Originally, the plan was to form a task force with representatives from the downtown SSMID, City and Economic Alliance. The SSMID will then vote on whether to keep contracting with the Alliance for services, hire for its own services, or contract with another entity. The SSMID tapped Denver-based Progressive Urban Management Associates to advise on possible changes to its structure, as the consultants already are familiar with downtown Cedar Rapids, having helped draft the updated downtown vision plan. To strengthen downtown services, the plan suggests a strengthened public-private downtown management approach. It weighed the pros and cons of the existing management structure and explored two alternatives: creating a more distinct downtown business center within the Alliance, or having the SSMID contract with an independent nonprofit. Because of a lack of consensus between Cedar Rapids city officials, the SSMID, and the Alliance on Downtown Organizational Management, PUMA President Brad Siegel previously said the consultants did not make a recommendation for which option was best. The plan urges a business plan for the preferred option and collaboration among those leaders to decide. The loose plan was to have 9 members on the task force, a member each from the Alliance and City, some property owners within the district who are not on the commission, and 5 commission members. The commission budgeted $10,000 for the task force. SSMID Commission Chair James Klein, president of Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust, in January said the effort was expected to take about 90 days. Randy Rings, True North's general counsel, said after getting input from PUMA and the City of Cedar Rapids, "We reached the conclusion that it'd be more efficient to move forward just with a SSMID committee. This panel's work is expected to take about 60 days to complete." The SSMID's executive committee, Rings, SSMID Chair James Klein, and Commission Member Ted Kepros approved the makeup of this panel. In addition to those 3, others asked to serve on the committee include Commission Member John Dusek, Kathy Turakina, Executive Vice President of Folience, the Gazette's parent company, and a former Commission member, Tim Kindle, co-owner of Fun Not Fancy Restaurant Group, Commission Member Danette Tobin. O'Donnell previously told the Gazette she wants the city to have a vote on the task force, but not the final vote before the SSMID. She also has suggested the Alliance had a financial stake in keeping downtown within the Alliance, though the Alliance receives little from the SSMID for administrative support and spends money to run events such as the farmers market. O'Donnell said Friday she is good with the plan that's now in place. PUMA consultants will provide input based on information they gathered in the process of drafting the downtown vision plan, as well as other examples of how similar districts operate around the U.S. Beyond that, and the discussions with Alliance and city officials, Rings said the panel will determine whether additional information is needed to make a recommendation. The goal is for the committee to provide a recommendation to the 15-member SSMID Commission to consider at its May 29th meeting, Rings said. While the SSMID deliberates potential structural shakeups, it's seeing another change in the Alliance staff who work on downtown initiatives. Nikki Wilcox's last day was Thursday as the Alliance's Strategic Development Director. She worked on administrative and strategic tasks pertaining to downtown, while new program manager Jennifer Bassett is focused on building relationships with downtown stakeholders and executing SSMID goals. Bassett succeeded Jesse Thoming, who resigned last fall after he was moved from his downtown executive director position into program management. Bassett and Cedar Rapids Community Development Director Jennifer Pratt, the city's liaison to the three SSMIDs, meet monthly. Downtown businesses and other stakeholders report to Bassett, while council members and other city officials can communicate through Pratt. Wilcox had not yet announced her next steps, but she said she'll work for another downtown organization and plans to stay involved in the city center. The North Liberty Police Department Officers Union and Sergeants Union released a letter Friday saying they have no confidence in Chief Diane Veninga. Despite our best efforts to work collaboratively and constructively, the leadership has consistently fallen short of the standards expected of a police chief. We believe that the continued tenure of Chief Veninga jeopardizes the integrity and effectiveness of our department and undermines public trust in law enforcement, the letter states. The unions met Sunday to address growing and consistent concerns with working conditions and to complete a satisfaction survey, the letter states. The survey results, which are included with the letter, show about 90% of officers gave Veninga a 1 out of 5 rating for creating team environment, promotes positive attitude within the department, and has a thorough understanding of NLPD issues. After the survey was administered Sunday, the unions unanimously voted no confidence in Veninga's ability to lead the department, according to the letter. Both unions felt this no-confidence vote was necessary after a multitude of attempts throughout several years had yielded no results in regard to correcting issues within the department, the letter states. Veninga forwarded a Gazette request for comment to North Liberty spokesman Nick Burgess, who said the union letter was presented Sunday night to North Liberty's mayor, city council, and administrative staff. The document the unions provided offered no explanation. Prior to Sunday, no leadership concerns had been brought to the attention of the Chief of Police, Diane Veninga, City Administrator Ryan Heyer, or Mayor Chris Hoffman, Burgess said in an email. The letter said that in 2017, a similar survey was conducted and Veninga promised to make positive changes in the department. But no adjustments have been made, and those who voiced questions regarding the situation were often met with hostility and retaliation from Chief Veninga. The letter listed a number of specific grievances, including poor communication, ambiguous time-off policies, and not hiring or retaining enough officers. Burgess said the city is conducting an internal review after receiving the letter. Veninga has been with the department since it started in 1999. She was one of two officers initially hired there. She has been the full-time chief since 2013. The City of Manchester is examining its legal options after a jury last week ordered the city to pay $4.25 million to the family of a man killed in a crash with a police officer in 2020. We respect the jury's verdict, Manchester Mayor Connie Bankin said Friday. However, we are looking at our options and it may be pending further litigation. The officer who was involved in the crash, James Wessels, retired from the department in February 2022, according to a deposition taken for the lawsuit. Records show Wessels was involved in a high-speed chase on December 10, 2020, with Augustin Gus Mormon, who was riding a motorcycle. A A lawsuit filed by his parents asserted that Wessels forced Mormon off the road, causing a crash that led to Mormon's death about a month later. According to the lawsuit and police reports, other officers had ended the pursuit for safety reasons, but Wessels continued. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra are asking the Social Security Administration to investigate the Sioux City field office after receiving a tip about long delays in claims processing at the office. The Iowa politicians, both Republicans, sent a letter to Inspector General Gail Ennis asking the agency to review complaints at the field office. Feenstra's district includes Sioux City. In the letter provided by Ernst's office, they said the field office's response to routine requests often takes weeks to months, and the office is dismissive or provides no substantive updates when presented with concerns. The letter included an email that Ernst's office received from an organizational payee, an organization that manages Social Security payments, with concerns. The payee said in an email to a manager that they had sent 12 intake forms to the field office, some dating to December, without receiving responses. The Social Security Administration did not respond to a request for comment. While Ernst did not provide any evidence that the delays were caused by remote work, she tied the complaints to her push for federal workers to return to the office. The letter pointed to the low number of workers in the agency's Washington headquarters and said the field office delays are no surprise. Feenstra echoed the remote work concerns and said the office should be doing more to get benefits to people on time. A June 2023 report on disability claim wait times in the agency pointed to telework during the pandemic as one of several causes of increased wait times. Other factors included the agency hiring new staff and losing experienced staff, and changes in policy and procedures. Last August, Ernst asked the Inspector General at the 24 major federal agencies to investigate their remote work practices. In a response to that letter, Ennis said management of staff, including the loss of experienced workers, is contributing to the agency's challenges. She said some staff have left to pursue jobs with a more flexible workload and remote work. Most workers at the SSA, including field office workers, are required to work in person at least 3 days per week, Ennis said in the letter. She said the agency is reviewing the impact of remote work on productivity. With perhaps the exception of the New York City metro area, historian Martin Javer says the heritage of Slovakians in America is in trouble. Outside of the Big Apple, where new waves of Slavic immigration are still happening, most Americans of Slovakian descent are 3 to 4 generations removed. Most do not speak the language their grandparents spoke, and there are few places to learn it in the United States. But it's not just Americans who are losing touch with their roots. Those in Slovakia, where he lives and works, are largely unaware of the New World routes many of their relatives took, or what happened after emigration. That's why Javer, who said he is the only professor studying this subject in Central Europe, established the Museum of Emigration from Slovakia to North America in Pavlovce nad Uhlom, Slovakia. I tell my students that one of the only things that's important is to know where you and your ancestors are from, Javer said. It's important to show the people in the U.S. the interest about cultural heritage of Slavic Americans here in Slovakia. It's very important because during the communist regime, it was forbidden to have any research about immigration. a new geology and cultural symposium at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in April will bring together speakers and presenters from around the world for sessions on the history of Czechs and Slavics and help attendees learn how they can trace their own lineage. With a major conference biennially and a smaller symposium in alternating years, the Czechoslovak Genealogical Society International is seeing more interest in researching heritage from people across the spectrum of ethnicities, including Czechs, Slavics, and the East Slavic Carpatho-Russians. Given that one of the last major waves of Slavic immigration to America happened before World War I, there's a lot of time to cover. Javer, who has collected artifacts from Slavic Americans and had grandparents who were born in the United States, said the knowledge about lives of Slovakians in America is limited, compounded by the Slavic integration and blending with other ethnic groups. Descendants in America today have virtually no reflection of Slavic culture. Next month, his presentation will include the role of Slovakians in the U.S. Army. For those wanting to reconnect to their roots, he has started a new way to do it symbolically. Attendees at the symposium will be able to buy heirloom trees to plant at the museum's garden in Slovakia, the types of trees that Slovakians brought to North America. With a $300 donation, donors can purchase a tree and receive a certificate to replant their roots in Slovakia. Kathy Palmquist, second vice president of the society, got more involved in the organization and genealogy research about 6 years ago when she retired. After hearing tidbits of family history from her parents over the years, she wanted to continue the work they were passionate about. Over a few years, volunteers have painstakingly put together maps of Czech and Slavic cemeteries that link to online catalogs detailing those buried there, the churches or organizations in charge of the grounds, and more. Some cemeteries are small, inactive, and difficult to find information about. Others, such as Bohemian National Cemeteries, demonstrate a mindset from past waves of immigrants. With a resurgence in genealogy research interest, thanks to platforms like Ancestry.com or 23andMe, Palmquist said cemeteries are critical in retracing your roots. There was significant rainfall in the past week across northwest Iowa, with much of that area receiving at least 2 inches of precipitation, according to the National Weather Service. That helped reverse drought conditions that have been pestering Iowa for more than 3 years. The state's overall dryness is now comparable to what it was in August, before accelerated to a new peak last fall, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. About 71% of the state is suffering from some measure of drought, down from nearly all of the state at its worst. But Iowa is still substantially drier than a year ago, when less than a third of the state had drought. Small areas of central Iowa had at least 4 inches of precipitation in the past week. A portion of far southeast Iowa had less than a half inch, but that area also has been wetter than the rest of the state. Some of it has no drought designation. The driest area is the northeast quadrant of the state that has extreme drought, the second to worst classification, shrunk by about a third in the past week. Drought is expected to persist there in the summer, according to the Federal Climate Prediction Center, but it should continue to ease in the southwest half of the state. Counties experiencing extreme drought include all of Linn, Benton, Buchanan, and Floyd counties, as well as portions of Blackhawk, Bremer, Butler, Cedar, Cerro Gordo, Chickasaw, Clayton, Delaware, Fayette, Franklin, Howard, Iowa, Johnson, Jones, Mitchell, Poweshiek, Tama, Washington, and Worth counties. The recent rains have been a boon to rivers in western Iowa, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Nearly all of those rivers it monitors have normal or above normal flow. An example, the surface of the North Raccoon River near Jefferson has risen about 4 feet since the start of the week. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 30th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Teresa Clara Smith, 96, of Norway, passed away March 27th at Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Teresa was born September 15, 1925, in Norway. She graduated from Norway High School, class of 1943. Following his time in the U.S. Navy, Teresa married Edward Smith on February 4, 1947. Working side by side, they owned and operated Ed's Budweiser for 20 years. Following the tavern, Teresa worked at Killian's and JCPenney's department stores, from which she retired. She was a member of St. Michael's of Norway and the Women's Catholic Order of Foresters. Mass of Christian burial is 11 a.m. Monday, April 1st at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Norway. Visitation is prior to the service from 9 to 11 a.m. Burial will take place at St. Michael's Cemetery in Norway. Memorials may be directed to the family. Michael R. Snyder, 71, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, March 27th. Michael was born on January 24, 1953, in Cedar Rapids. He loved collecting and repairing any clock, from pocket watches to grandfather clocks. He was an avid collector of antiques and anything rusty. Michael also donated his corneas to help people in need. Memorials may be directed to the family. John Glazier of Toddville passed away peacefully on March 19th after a hard-fought battle with Alzheimer's disease. Born in Esterville, John spent much of his childhood near Grattinger, where his grandparents owned a local cafe. After high school, John spent 2 years in junior college before joining the Air Force, where he dedicated 8 years of service. During that time, he met and married Kelly Glazier, his wife of 50 years. Together, they spent 3 years in Japan. After leaving the Air Force, they returned to Cedar Rapids, where John worked for 24 years at Square D and 10 years at Collins before retiring. He enjoyed ham radio, tending to his two-acre property, and time with his family. Gabriel Cifuentes of Marion. As a young child, Gabe loved to tell stories, which would later become one of his life's passions. He started writing for the school newspaper in Belle Plaine, and that led him to doing correspondence for the Iowa Hawkeyes basketball teams. By the time he was in junior high, he had written at least 3 books. He decided then to go back to school at Warren Wilson College and got a bachelor's degree in creative writing. The following year, he decided to obtain a master's degree in his other passion, divinity. There will be a celebration of life soon where family and friends are invited. Paul Anthony McCarthy, 76, of Iowa City, died at home on Monday, March 25th. A memorial service will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th, at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Family will greet guests prior to the service from 10 to 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Paul was born on April 12, 1947, in Oakland, California. Earned a Bachelor of Arts degree from San Francisco State University and served from 1965 to 1968 in the U.S. Army. On June 12, 1993, Paul married Patricia Van Heck at St. Clair Church in Lyndhurst, Ohio. Paul was an award-winning news producer and newsroom executive at local television stations in West Virginia, Kansas City, Missouri, New Haven, Connecticut, and in Davenport, and a short-lived ABC News Bureau in St. Louis, Missouri. In 1997, he moved his family to Iowa City for work with the Telemedicine Project at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics Center for Disabilities and Development. He volunteered for his children's activities in schools, served as the Eagle Scout advisor for Boy Scout Troop 212, the Thoughtful Gentleman, for several years, and was a member of St. Thomas More Church in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed online to the Foundation for the ICCSD for the One Tray at a Time project to erase student meal debt, or by mail to 1725 North Dodge Street, Iowa City 52245, or to Iowa City Hospice. Marla Jean Meyer, age 81, of Riverside, died Thursday, March 28th, at Parkview Manor in Wellman. The family will be present to receive friends and celebrate Marla's life from 5 until 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 2nd, at the Jones and Eden Funeral Home in Washington. A private interment will be at a later date for the family. Emily Catherine Starbuck, 87, died Wednesday, March 27th, at Crestview Care Center in West Branch. A celebration of life will be held at a later date at Sutcliffe Bridge. And a couple of death notices from El Burnett. Jane Marie Shantz, 80, died Thursday, March 28th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Marion in charge. From Cedar Rapids, Michael R. Snyder, 71, passed away Wednesday, March 27th. Services are pending with the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Point, Lorena Fern Carr, 96, died Thursday, March 28th. Services are pending with Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton. From Monona, Patricia Green, 93, died Saturday, January 27th. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona is helping the family with the arrangements. From Old Wine, Juanita McClish, 80, died Wednesday, March 27th. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home in charge. From Shellsburg, Charles Lee Davis, 87, died Friday, March 29th. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cedar Rapids in charge of arrangements. In West Union, Alice Catherine Peters, 94, died Wednesday, March 27th. Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. And some sports news. The Cedar Rapids River Kings won't be the only indoor football team in the state for the 2025 American indoor football season. Indoor football is coming to the Iowa City area with the Coralville Chaos set to join the league next season. The team was officially revealed to the public in a news conference on Thursday. Home games will be played inside of Extreme Arena. The majority owner will be Dominique Montero, who also is the primary owner of the River Kings. Montero feels strongly Iowa City is a great fit for a new indoor football team, the same way he felt about bringing back the River Kings to Cedar Rapids. The team's name, Chaos, he said, helps describe the excitement indoor football can bring. The River Kings are 1-1 in their first two non-league games, with an 87-14 win over the Missouri Falcons and a close loss to the Colorado Spartans, 35-26. Next up is one last non-league game against the Newton Nighthawks tonight at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Kickoff is set for 7 p.m. We want to use these games as a tune-up to help us get prepared for league play and to see where we are at, Montero said. Colorado was a great test for us, especially without having our starting kicker and star player, Ricky Neal, Jr. The River Kings' first league game will be April 6th at the Harrisburg Stampede with their home league opener on May 10th against the Mississippi Raiders. Earth's changing spin is threatening to toy with our sense of time, clocks, and computerized society in an unprecedented way, but only for a second. For the first time in history, world timekeepers may have to consider subtracting a second from our clocks in a few years because the planet is rotating a tad faster than it used to. Clocks may have to skip a second, called a negative leap second, around 2029, a study in the Journal of Nature said Wednesday. Ice melting at Earth's poles has been counteracting the planet's burst of speed and is likely to have delayed this global second of reckoning by about 3 years, said Duncan Agnew, a geophysicist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. It's a complicated situation that involves physics, global power politics, climate change technology, and two types of time. Earth takes about 24 hours to rotate, but the key word is about. For thousands of years, the Earth has been generally slowing down, said Agnew and Judah Levine, a physicist for the Time and Frequency Division of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The slowing is mostly caused by the effect of tides, which are caused by the pull of the moon, McCarthy said. This didn't matter until atomic clocks were adopted as the official time standard more than 55 years ago. Those didn't slow. That established two versions of time, astronomical and atomic, and they didn't match. Astronomical time fell behind atomic time by 2.5 milliseconds every day. That meant the atomic clock would say it's midnight, and to Earth it was midnight a fraction of a second later, Agnew said. Those daily fractions of seconds added up to whole seconds every few years. Starting in 1972, international timekeepers decided to add a leap second in June or December for astronomical time to catch up to the atomic time, called Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC. Instead of 11:59 and 59 seconds turning to midnight, there would be another second at 11:59 and 60 seconds. A negative leap second would go from 11:59 and 58 seconds directly to midnight, skipping 11:59:59. Between 1972 and 2016, 27 separate leap seconds were added as Earth slowed, but the rate of slowing was tapering off. In 2016 or 2017, maybe even 2018, the slowdown rate had slowed down to the point that the Earth was actually speeding up, Levine said. Earth's speeding up because its hot liquid core, a large ball of molten fluid, acts in unpredictable ways, with eddies and flows that vary, Agnew said. He added that the core has been triggering a speed-up for about 50 years, but rapid melting of ice at the poles since 1990 masked that effect. Melting ice shifts Earth's mass from the poles to the bulging center, which slows the rotation much like a spinning ice skater slows when extending their arms out to their sides. Without the effect of melting ice, Earth would need that negative leap second in 2026 instead of 2029, Agnew calculated. For decades, astronomers had been keeping universal and astronomical time together with those handy little leap seconds. But computer system operators said those additions aren't easy for all the precise technology the world now relies on. McCarthy said, What is the need for this adjustment in time when it causes so many problems? But Russia's satellite system relies on astronomical time, so eliminating leap seconds would cause them problems, Agnew and McCarthy said. Astronomers and others wanted to keep the system that would add a leap second whenever the difference between atomic and astronomical time neared a second. In 2022, the world's timekeepers decided that starting in the 2030s, they'd change the standards for inserting or deleting a leap second, making it much less likely. Tech companies such as Google and Amazon unilaterally instituted their own solutions to the leap second issue by gradually adding fractions of a second over a full day, Levine said. McCarthy said the trend toward needing a negative leap second is clear, but he thinks it's more to do with the Earth becoming more round from geological shifts from the end of the last ice age. Three outside scientists said Agnew's study does make sense, calling his evidence compelling. In some courtroom drama, a deputy state medical examiner testified Friday that the knife used to stab Devonna Walker penetrated her left lung and aorta, which resulted in her bleeding to death. The depth of the horizontal stab wound was 9 centimeters, about 3.5 inches, and the injury went from left to right and front to back. Dr. Jonathan Thompson, a forensic pathologist, testified Friday in Linn County District Court. The wound, he said, was one of the deeper ones I've seen. The amount of force was considerable because it went through muscle between the ribs, the left lung, and the pericardial sac around the heart and penetrated the aorta, he said. Walker, 29, who was 5'7" tall and weighed 221 pounds, lost about 2 liters of blood, which put her in the danger zone, Thompson said. Walker was fatally stabbed January 2, 2023, when an argument escalated and she assaulted a neighbor, Shane Teslick, 38, and Teslick stabbed her once in the left chest outside his apartment at the Cambridge Townhouses, 2135 North Town Court Northeast. According to testimony, Teslick threatened to kill Walker and called her a racial epithet before she punched him. Teslick is claiming self-defense or in defense of others. The prosecution continues its case Monday. The trial is expected to wrap up next week. Thompson testified, as autopsy photos were shown to the jury, that Walker didn't have any other injuries such as torn skin, scrapes, or bruising on her hands. According to earlier testimony and a video of the assault, Walker punched Teslick twice before he stabbed her. Thompson said this toxicology report, as part of the autopsy report, showed Walker had alcohol, methamphetamine, cocaine, and marijuana in her system. He couldn't say how much she was under the influence of the drugs because some drugs can stay in the system longer than others, and it depends whether a person has built up a tolerance to them. On cross-examination by the defense, Thompson said he couldn't say how any of those drugs affected her behavior or actions that night. Thompson said the cause of death was the stab wound. In other testimony, two Cedar Rapids police officers said when they arrived after the stabbing, the scene was chaotic, with numerous people running around or standing around in the immediate area of Teslick's apartment, and others were outside of their apartments. Officer Bryce Anders said he started CPR on Walker, who had been rolled over on her back. There was a large pool of blood in the grassy area, and she had blood on the left side of her chest. A woman, Stephanie Hill, told him she had a video of the incident. She also pointed to Jesse Chavez, Teslick's girlfriend, as being the person who did it. Chavez was later taken into custody for questioning, along with Teslick. During Anders' testimony, the prosecution played the 911 call that Teslick made. The video is difficult to hear because Teslick is screaming and yelling on the call, The dispatcher has to ask several times for him to calm down and tell her what happened. Teslick, on the call, said he stabbed someone and is repeatedly yelling about the police should have done something before this happened, referencing previous calls made by Chavez about their disputes with Walker and her alleged assaultive behavior. Officer Zachary O'Hare said when he arrived, Chavez was hysterical and was staying near Walker, who was on the ground, and started approaching officers. O'Hare said he'd been told she was a potential suspect, so he placed her in handcuffs, which she resisted until she was taken in for questioning. At the police department, O'Hare took photos of Teslick for possible injuries. He had a small scrape on his nose. That photo was shown to the jury. O'Hare, who wasn't part of the interview process with Teslick and Chavez, said the two were taken home after being questioned. Two neighbors in the Cambridge townhouses also testified that they heard Teslick arguing with Walker and calling her a racial epithet. Lacey Kelb, 32, of Cedar Rapids, who lived in the townhouses in January 2023, said she didn't know Teslick or Chavez by name, but recognized them as the neighbors who were arguing with Walker, who she also recognized as a neighbor on January 2, 2023. The three were arguing in front of Teslick and Chavez's apartment that night, Kelb testified. She saw Teslick was pacing and attempting to get Chavez to come inside. The three were arguing about Teslick's dog, who Walker thought was aggressive. She heard Teslick and Chavez use a racial epithet. Kelb said she went inside, and when she went back outside for a smoke, Walker was on the ground. Chavez was yelling at her, saying she was faking it. Teslick came out to get the dog, then went back inside. Michelle Foster, 48, who still lives in the Cambridge complex, testified she was acquainted with Walker because their sons went to the same school. She recognized Chavez and Teslick as neighbors. A few weeks before Christmas, she saw a heated argument between Walker and the couple. Teslick was aggressive, cursing at Walker and calling her a racial epithet. Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks asked if he appeared to be violent, and Foster said, yes. Walker told Teslick to go away, Foster said. And for those of you who own a dog, it's that time of year. Spring is here, and that means spring cleaning. To ensure that you and your pup are ready for the new season, the American Kennel Club offers the following spring cleaning tips. Groom your dog. Shedding can increase drastically in the spring because dogs lose their winter coats. Regular brushing can help control the shedding, and brushing down to your dog's skin can loosen and remove dead hair and dander that will make your dog's coat neat and clean for the new season. Give your dog a bath. Always brush your dog before bathing, as matted hair holds water and can irritate your dog's skin. Wash your dog's coat thoroughly with lukewarm water and dog shampoo, making sure to rinse well and not leave any soapy residue behind. Clean paws. Springtime is often deemed mud season, especially by dog owners. Outdoor play in the dirt and grass leads to muddy paw prints all over the floor. To keep your dog and house clean, use a damp cloth to gently clean each paw when your pup comes in from playing outside. Make sure to get in between each toe to remove mud and debris. Wash your pup's bed. First, vacuum excess hair and dirt from your dog bed. To make washing of your dog's bed easier, use a fabric cover that can be easily removed to wash using a non-scented detergent. It is not recommended to use any fabric softeners, as those can be irritating to your dog's skin. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 30th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Happy Easter, and thanks for listening.